My name is Justin Gage. You tuned in to the Aquarium Drunkard Transmissions Podcast with your host, Jason Woodbury.
Welcome back to another episode of Aquarium Drunkard Transmissions. So glad to have you here with us once again. This week on the show, I am joined by reissue producer and author and musician and general scholar of the counterculture, Pat Thomas. As you will hear at the very beginning of this chat, Pat was one of the first people who I ever asked to be on the interview series version of Transmissions. For those who have been following the feed for a long time, in the early days, this was a feed that was populated by freeform music mixes compiled by Aquarium Drunkard founder Justin Gage. Meanwhile, he's doing his radio show, and around 2016, I started thinking, inspired by people like Vish Khanna of Creative Control and Jesse Thorne from Bullseye, and of course, Mark Maron and others, I started thinking about having an interview show, and I asked Pat to do it because I had, you know, always enjoyed my many run-ins with Pat. He's a reissue producer and has been involved in pivotal stuff, especially the stuff he was reissuing back on Water Records, but I got in touch with him through his work with Light in the Attic and much more, and talked with him about his books like Listen Whitey, and Invitation to Openness, these great collections he was doing with Fantagraphics, one of my all-time favorite publishers. Pat is stayed so incredibly busy, and he was busy then when I first asked him to be on. I taped an interview with him, and that same weekend, an interview with some members of Tortoise, and John Herndon and Jeff Parker. Both of those interviews, I botched the recording. I was so nervous. I was unprepared. And it's a real drag to look back on it. But, you know, that's part of what you have to do in order to start doing something. Those who've been listening have obviously heard me, change as this podcast is go on, hopefully get a slightly better grasp on it. And that's why I'm so glad after all of this time to be able to have a proper interview with Pat Thomas here in the Transmissions archives, which we are really excited about because it's a busy year for Pat. One of his many projects right now is Material Wealth, mining the personal archive of Allen Ginsberg. And that's a visual deep dive into Ginsberg's manuscripts, letters, photographs, and a compilation of his, you know, interactions with all sorts of folks, everybody from Bob Dylan to Paul McCartney to Kerouac and Norman Mailer and Mary Baraka and many more. Meanwhile, Pat has got a companion soundtrack to that as well, which features Ginsberg accompanied by people like Dylan and McCartney, Elvin Jones, Lenny Kaye, Philip Glass, David Mansfield, David Amram, Arthur Russell, so many more. Ginsberg is one of the most fascinating folks of that beat generation and the countercultural history that Pat covers. So it's clear that his love for Ginsberg has compelled him to get deeper and deeper and deeper. You can find more conversations between Pat and I at Aquarium Drunkard, just back and forth, in terms of text. But I'm so excited to have this podcast interview going because there's more stuff that Pat's been involved with. He's somebody who we can thank largely for the rediscovery of Judy Sill, or the preservation of the music Judy Sill made, along with Andy Zaks, who's been on Transmissions. Pat has been a booster of her music and has worked with the estate to make sure that so much crucial Judy Sill recordings get out. And so it's fitting that he's our guest this week, because on April 12th, we're finally going to see the release of Lost Angel, the genius of Judy Sill, a documentary that was directed by Andy Brown and Brian Lindstrom, all about Judy Sill. And this year also sees the release of Pat's long-running improvisational combo Mushroom and their album Messages from the Spliff Bunker. So there's lots of great reasons to have Pat on this week, and I'm so excited to share this one with you. We recorded it very, very early in the year, which is why you'll hear me sort of in a reflective mode about what 2024 might be like. I'm not sure if I was really onto anything, but I think this was a great conversation nonetheless, and I hope you enjoy it. And I want to tease another great conversation that is on the way on Saturday, April 20th, 420. Aquarium Drunkard is teaming up with our friends at the Philosophical Research Society in Los Angeles. Their great plant stock event is going on, and there's going to be a live taping of Transmissions there. Here's the catch. I'm not going to be there. I have to be in New York for work, but I will be so proud to turn the Transmissions reins over to Will Sheff of Okkervil River, who's got a great episode of Transmissions in the archives, one of my favorites. And he's going to be speaking with another great writer, Sean Howe, about his fantastic book about Thomas King Forsaad, founder of High Times, Agents of Chaos. It's an essential book and an essential read, and I think it's going to be a great hang. So we want to encourage you to get some tickets to that. And then, you know, stand by for all of those of you who are outside of LA, because we're going to be able to feature that conversation here in the feed. Of course, we launched our subscription service for Aquarium Drunkard this week as well, so I want to encourage you to go over and pledge your support to us by subscribing to the magazine. Our online music magazine is going to be powered exclusively by our subscribers as we move forward. And for those of you who are still checking out the Patreon, expect some cool bonus content from the Transmissions podcast over on that front, but we're encouraging you to pledge your primary support to Aquarium Drunkard by subscribing, and we appreciate you doing so. Without further ado, how about we get into it? This conversation with reissue producer and author and countercultural head, Pat Thomas. I hope you enjoy this conversation. Thanks so much for hanging out with us here on Aquarium Drunkard Transmissions. I will speak with you a little more on the other side. Hey, Pat, how are you?
Good. I realize it's almost a decade ago that we did the first interview that got tanked.
I was thinking about that. I put a note in here. I don't know if it was maybe 2016?
Really? It feels like longer ago, but that's possible. You know what? You're right. I guess it wasn't a decade ago.
These last couple of years have simultaneously felt longer and shorter. It's a very strange phenomenon. Right.
But the one thing I think we can agree on is that I've done a hell of a lot since then.
Well, I was thinking, like, on one hand, I was like, well, yeah, it was so kind of you to appear on that botched, entirely of my own botching.
Right.
That interview, I look back and I'm like, I'm kind of glad we're doing it now in some ways, because I found my footing a lot more with this show and with my interviewing style. And as you mentioned, you've done so much in that time. You remain incredibly busy and productive. And I wonder, we'll just dive straight in to keep it nice and conversational. What does downtime look like for Pat Thomas? How do you chill out? Do you ever chill out?
Well, you know, it's funny. I did this Jerry Rubin book, as you know, we've discussed it, and I crisscrossed the country. And one of the most amazing events for me was in Chicago, where I was interviewed by Bill Ayers of the Weather Underground. And then afterwards, Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn, also the Weather Underground, had a small party for me at their house. And, you know, they're sort of rock stars of the radical left of the 60s. So then after I was done, I went back to my buddy's apartment. And, you know, some people would have had a beer, or maybe they would have smoked a joint. I was watching a documentary on Henry Kissinger, right? Like, that's why I was chilling out.
Okay. So further research, deeper immersion.
Yeah, downtime for me is more research. And it doesn't necessarily have to be for something specific. For example, I'm not, wasn't working on a Henry Kissinger project, but, you know, his political arc ties into the 60s and 70s, obviously. I sort of entertain myself. I do a lot of reading. I think I read more than many people do. That said, I'm making myself like the ultimate nerd here. I'm happy to prop up a bar stool and pound some mezcal.
Sure.
You know? So don't get me wrong. I'm not a church mouse.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. When it comes to the stuff that you do watch or read or dig in, you know, I've always found, or I've found the more I've tried, you know, different creative projects myself, that there has to be some sort of innate enthusiasm for the topic in order to complete any work, you know. Are you pretty much, has this been like your work broadly, it covers a lot of ground, but you could say broadly is focused on the counterculture of the 60s and 70s. Has that always been an area of extreme interest for you?
Yeah. I mean, I'm born in 64, so it's not like I fully remember the 60s, right? However, you know, I do remember the tail end of it, and especially the early 70s. But what set me on this journey a bit was I had a brother who was 9 years older. So when other 10-year-old kids were getting their Archie's comic books or something, and I did some of that too. Again, I don't want to sound like I'm different than everybody else, but I was, you know, my brother brought Abby Hoffman's Steal This Book into the house.
Yeah.
When other kids were probably checking out the Partridge Family albums, I already had Who's Next and Rod Stewart, Every Picture Tells a Story. Again, only because of my older brother, not because I was like some, you know, child prodigy of music and literature. So this goes deep. And so by the time I'm 16, you know, I'm already kind of exploring Ginsberg and Kerouac. And in fact, I felt so out of place in high school that I actually quit high school after the 10th grade and enrolled in a community college.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, because you don't need a high school diploma to attend community college. So, and because a college semester is a little shorter than high school, I actually graduate college a month before my friends graduate high school.
Wow.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
so
sure.
I get a two-year degree a month after my 18th birthday. And my buddies graduate high school a month after I get my two-year degree. So
yeah.
So I've been a little bit ahead of the curve on this stuff a bit, you know.
When you, what was your relationship with your brother like? Were you guys close?
Well, he was kind of my hero because he was into, you know, he had an Easy Rider movie poster on the wall.
Yeah.
And, you know, he dressed in, you know, some hippie garb. What's funny is that he became over time, sort of culturally and politically conservative, why got deeper, you know. So, you know, we still get along great, and he's proud of my adventures. But by the time I was, let's say, in my early 20s and he was approaching 30, he wasn't really into this stuff anymore.
Sure, you know? Sure. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know.
That's funny. That's funny to consider the way, you know, you hear about people who drift, you know, politically in different alignments over the course of their life, you know.
Right.
But your work has pretty squarely put you in the, like you said, the radical left camp, at least in terms of your interests, which, looking at your 2024 slate of projects, the ones that I know of, at least, you've got a ton of stuff. You've got, you know, you've got this great Ginsberg collection, and we can get into a little of the specifics of all of this.
Sure.
But it's funny, the way I imagine this next year going is, you know, I've kind of found myself mired in dread about what is going to happen over the course of another presidential election, one in which, you know, it feels like this last decade or so has kind of torn away most of the illusions of a sort of veneer, you know, that we're all on the same side or whatever. So I find myself curious about what it's going to look like. But in some ways, I think that, you know, I was listening to the Days of Rage audiobook about the radical underground of the 60s. Yeah. And it's a reminder that as frazzled or as strange as it might seem right now, things used to be far more heated, you know. I mean, there was like bombing. There were bombings on a regular basis, and it's like it's kind of a reminder that as crazy as things have gotten, they are in some ways the arena has moved into this sort of online sphere. You know, at least in part. Not that there aren't real demonstrations and real objections.
You know, in the 60s, I think that the left had some key common goals, which was to end the Vietnam War, civil rights and black power. A little later in the 60s, early 70s, women's rights, gay rights. We've become, in my opinion, a little more about personal politics, which is both good and bad, right? And I think that one of the problems with the left, of which I consider myself part of, in case anyone's wondering, is that we're looking for reasons to be insulted. In other words, you know, obviously, you know, gender issues are a hot topic, and rightfully so, right? And you've got the them and the they and the he, you know, I get all that, but I think that we've kind of gotten into this thing of, oh, you know, I watched this Pat Thomas podcast, and I think he might have been anti blah blah blah, right? And everybody gets up in arms.
Sure,
right?
Sure.
Or Facebook. I mean, sometimes it can be benign. I mean, I'm kind of half serious, half joking. Like, I might post, I just had a pizza, and someone else will go, well, what's wrong with hamburgers?
Well,
I'm
yeah.
serious.
No, I know. That's,
yeah, I'm serious. It's gotten very effed up. You know, like, in other words, and this is one of the reasons why it's hard for us to elect a Democratic candidate. And that I really think it's one of the reasons why, you know, I don't even hating saying his name, we'll just call him Donald, won in 2016, because it was like, there is no perfection. You want the perfect candidate? You know what? God is not running, right? And so we've gotten into this thing of like, oh, her emails, right?
Right.
I mean, but that's just indicative of our whole culture. I mean, I see it. I saw an essay once attacking Gandhi, of all people, who I think was pretty amazing, because in his early 20s, I guess he was a bit of a racist, right?
Right.
I don't care what he did in his early, what I care is what his overall life stands for.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, you know, that's, yeah, of course, like on a couple levels, I feel So, I mean, I know what you mean. You know, when it comes to the left has always eaten itself to some degree, yes, or another, right? And
right.
And it's not that it's not that the left has any exclusive claim on, you know, egotism or, you know, a sort of showy bravado in terms of these people creating characters, right, to portray themselves. The right does that too, you know, but to a certain degree, there is a cohesion of aim, you know, like you said, they're all after the same thing, you know.
Well, that's exactly right. I hate even talking about this jerk. There were a lot of people, I think, on the right who are not really big fans of Donald, but they're so eager to have one of their own in there, right? Mm-hmm. I wish that sometimes the left was a little bit more like that. Like, okay, Hillary isn't perfect, but let's get her butt in there, right? Or Biden or whoever, you know? Because again, you're searching for, there is no perfection, you know?
Sure. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, well, and it's interesting kind of what you're getting at, because like I said, this Ginsburg collection is up very close at the beginning of the year. You've got this great Material Wealth is the name of the collection, and it sets Ginsburg's poems and songs. It collects a pretty wide swath of them. And for folks who are listening, you know, who've heard Allen Ginsberg, obviously he's got a very distinct voice on his own, but the musicians who accompany him on this it's bonkers. You've got Paul McCartney and Dylan and Philip Glass,
right.
Arthur Russell, you know, and then of course, Lenny Kaye. I'm such a
big Elvin Jones.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of an insane collection of people who were all, you know, such massive fans of him. And when I think about Ginsberg in relation to the modern left, right? Or maybe in relation is the right way to put it, because here's this guy who is, you know, unabashedly queer, unabashedly sort of pushing all of these boundaries in a really incredible way, but also has this trickster slyness to his presentation, in which you don't get the sense that he kind of seemed to just sort of enjoy inserting himself into strange places, even places you might not think that he's going to turn up. And so I think when we ask ourselves, like, what could a character like Ginsberg have to teach us about the way to communicate to people, or what we should be communicating, I find him such a fascinating figure. But you've been really exploring his work for a long time. You said you were pretty young when you got into Ginsberg, right?
Yeah. So I first kind of got hip to him when I was 16. By the time I was 19, I wrote him a fan letter, and I was publishing a little fanzine in Rochester, New York called The Notebook. And I was cheeky enough to ask him for a previously unpublished poem. And he sent me this wonderful little, like, 3-line poem on his stationery. And then when he came to town, total coincidence, a few months later, I met him and interviewed him. And then as we got into the 90s, most people know me as a drummer, you know, I have the band Mushroom, and in the 80s, a band called Absolute Grey. In the 90s, I dabbled with my own sort of singer-songwriter stuff. And so I actually recorded a Ginsberg song called Don't Smoke. And when I sent it to Ginsberg, his assistants couldn't believe that somebody, in other words, I think I was the first person to record a cover of a Ginsberg song.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
So they're kind of like, what the heck is this, right?
Sure.
And that became the seed of my relationship with the Ginsberg estate, although this time he was still alive. But
right.
My point is, like, everybody loves Ginsberg poetry, relatively speaking. And so those types of fan letters, that type of adulation comes often. I was the first person to come to them and say, I dig this guy as a singer-songwriter.
Right.
So by the 90s or early 2000s, I guess it was, I started reissuing Ginsberg's music albums on CD. And then, of course, in more recent times, I did a 3-CD box set of Ginsberg singing, and then I did a 2-CD. So I've done 5 CDs worth of Ginsberg as a singer.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
People are like, what do you mean as a singer, right? I only know him as a poet, you know? So that was sort of my angle. And that led to me, you've already mentioned what I call the Material Wealth soundtrack CD, mm-hmm. but that's a companion piece to this giant fat coffee table book that just hit the streets, also called Material Wealth. And it's basically Ginsberg never threw anything away. Somewhere buried in his archives, although I didn't find them, or whatever letters that I sent him, but also things like 1974, he's at the Dylan and the Band reunion tour. He runs into Yoko Ono. He scribbles her phone number on the back of the ticket, you know, and kept it. He had heard sometime, I think probably in the late 60s, that the American Nazi Party wanted to assassinate him for being a gay commie Jew. So he writes them a letter suggesting they get together and talk about it.
I mean, yeah, that's what I'm talking. That's a kind of provocation that's also very, funny. It's like I said, you know, trickster.
It's funny, but it's also like another thing that's in the book is the transcription of a 1971 phone call between him and Henry Kissinger discussing the Vietnam War. Now, obviously, we've got Ginsberg on the far left, anti-Vietnam War, and we've got Kissinger on the far right, you know, deciding what bombs are going to get dropped. The problem we have today in 2023, 2024, is that many people, whether you're on the left or the right, will be like, well, I'm not talking to that guy. He's the enemy, right? Ginsberg was trying to understand Kissinger's way of thinking and see if there was any way to sway it, right? Like, we've lost the ability to have dialogues. I mean, there were times, and it now seems like ancient history, where Republicans and Democrats in Congress would go, well, of course strip mining is bad. Let's not do that. Or of course we shouldn't do offshore. You know, now it's like, and this is more of a right-wing thing, but I think it also happens left. Well, if you think it's a bad idea, then it must actually be a good idea.
Yeah, I don't know if you've had a chance to read, it's a really incredible book, Doppelganger by Naomi Klein.
I haven't.
It came out in 2023, and Naomi Klein, of course, is a critic and a social thinker who, this book is based in her getting mistaken for Naomi Wolf, who started off in a similar milieu politically, but then drifted more into sort of conspiracy culture, and she's really tight with Steve Bannon. And so Klein uses this as the sort of literary basis of her book, comparing and contrasting, and she creates this whole narrative about what she calls the mirror world, where every legitimate concern of, let's say, queer people who've been oppressed, or non-binary people whose gender identity is under constant, you know, attack from weirdos, you know, or whatever. She creates this world in where each one of those things ends up sort of having this parallel concern in this mirror world. And essentially she starts making the argument that that we begin to think of enemies as like so beyond the pale or so unlike us that we convince ourselves somehow that we don't share their foibles, or that, you know, or that by failing to address legitimate grievances, the left cedes a lot of ground to the right. And then we don't even want to be associated with the ground that's been ceded because it's so contaminated. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons why our modern situation is so... The 60s were also so fractured and crazy, but there were only how many television networks, right? I mean, there's a distillation of information and of channels of that information. Now there's a million little online rabbit holes where you can wander down and Robert Anton Wilson style reality tunnel, you know, your way through, never actually encountering other ideas. And so I wonder what good it does, you know, when people weaponize that kind of dialogue. But at the same time, I do, who knows? It seems to me like Ginsburg had, was it just like a devil may care style? Or do you think that there was like sort of a strategic aim at work with what he was doing?
Well, I think Ginsburg had a lot of empathy.
Sure.
Or what not just what the other side was feeling, but what everybody was feeling, right? He was an empathetic character. One of the reasons that even at the height of his fame, he tried to read and answer most, if not all, of his own fan mail.
Yeah, or even send unpublished poems to folks.
Yeah, to unknown people. He was the guy who helped to get, you know, Kerouac and Ginsburg. I mean, I'm sorry, I'm talking about Ginsburg. Ginsburg helped to get Kerouac and Burroughs and Herbert Honke and others published, mm-hmm. you know, even when he was still unknown, you know. So, you know, because most of us, we tend to like, hey, I got to worry about my own career. He was worried about his own career and five or six other careers, right?
Yeah, reading the incredible new John Sved book about Harry Smith was shocked that Ginsburg was supporting Harry Smith, you know, financially.
Yeah, that's right.
Amazing.
That's exactly right. And, you know, that's a rarer thing these days. I mean, one of the things I'm particularly proud of, I've helped both some well-known people from the left, Paul Krasner, who's now deceased, Judy Gumbo, who was one of the hippies. You know, I've helped these people get book deals, but yeah. I've also helped, when I was in grad school, unknown students get some book deals, you know, and I just want to make it clear, I'm not acting as an agent. I wasn't collecting my 10%
or whatever.
I mean, I really love supporting and promoting other people's stuff besides my own. And, you know, for people who follow me on social media, for every Pat Thomas, look at me, look at my new project post, there's usually several other posts of check out, you know, Fred Flintstone's book, check out Barney Rubble's new album. And sometimes I even feel guilty I'm not doing more of that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, so I enjoy doing it. You know, and I think Ginsburg did. I'm not sure what my end goal is with this.
I know what you mean. It's sort of just a willingness to help others and to extend his influence, right? And sort of like use that influence for something. It's funny. I was thinking and reading about the obviously the book and the accompanying soundtrack, and the notes mention the set that Hal Willner put together in the 90s for Rhino, which was I forget how many discs, but it was like a pretty
four massive discs of Ginsburg. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was thinking about how, you know, Hal Willner is somebody who I wish I could have got him on this show, you know, before he passed. But he's somebody who's come up over and over and over again on the podcast because he was constantly using his ability to, you know, get budgets approved and shine a light on, you know, weird people who weren't getting tons of mainstream recognition. And I've always found that to be such a cool use of when one has some influence, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I only got to know Hal just towards the end of his life. And we had a little bit of a mutual admiration society going. He was aware of my work. And in fact, one of the things that's kind of funny is I knew through friends that he had some of my books. But when someone first suggested we meet for lunch, he first goes, Pat Thomas, I'm not sure. And then he goes, oh, yeah, the guy from Mushroom. Like he identified initially for a second with my least known thing.
Yeah.
But that kind of plays into the lunch that we had, which is that no matter what topic we brought up at that lunch, and we were mostly talking about music and art and books, he could deep dive all of them. But not in a shaming way, not like, hey, Jason, I've got this rare Japanese Neil Young 12-inch that you don't have, right?
Yeah.
Like not in some sort of, you know, my my schlong is bigger than your schlong. It was more of like he was just, I mean, I don't want to really compare myself to him because he was so great, but it was almost like me times 1,000 in terms of like deep diving subjects, right?
Right.
And yeah, it was just incredible. But again, not in any show off, blowhard way. Just, I mean, you know, you asked me what I did in my spare time. I can't even imagine what the hell he was doing. You know, I mean, just about music and books and stuff. And, you know, we kind of tossed around some ideas. You know, I was working at that point with my good friend Josh Mills on an Ernie Kovacs book that's since come out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we had hoped to include Hal in part of that. Kovacs was a big influence. So, you know, the world lost God knows how many albums, box sets, books, God knows what, when Hal passed. You know, I mean, if he'd lived another 20 or 30 years, you know, there was been so much cool stuff, I'm sure, you know.
Yeah, yeah. No, his memory, you know, is looms large over this whole world of weirdo art, you know, stuff like that. But you hit on something that I think is really interesting, and it's the way you, be it, you know, Ginsberg as a songwriter or any of the numerous reissues that you've been a part of. I think we first started connecting that probably was close to a decade ago, you know, sort of about work you were doing with Light in the Attic and various different projects that you helped get into the world.
Yeah, definitely my Listen Whitey book, we connected on that.
Yeah, which is such an incredible collection and a deeply illuminating, you know, for me, you know, that was like a great, it wasn't like an intro to the Black Panthers, but certainly was a more more exploratory look at their art, the artistic sort of trail that they helped to inspire. But all of that, you know, there's this sense that you're somebody who, when you get on an idea and you want to share somebody's work, you'll go to sort of extreme lengths to do so. And I think about the work of Judy Sill and how you've been such a massive part of making sure that her story is not only not forgotten, but told in a fuller way. And I know that the documentary Lost Angel is it seems like that's maybe gonna come out finally
it's gonna be hitting theaters I think March, April. It'll open up in X amount of theaters. I think some deal has been made for streaming. I can't say for sure, but you know, an Amazon Prime or a Netflix or both,
right.
You know, and it actually all took a little longer than we thought. That might have been partially post-COVID, partially the writer's strike, even though obviously
it was already done. Yeah,
it was already done. But yeah, Judy is someone that I've been, you know, it all kind of started in the late 90s. There was no Judy Sill available anywhere. And the only way to hear her music were the first two albums on very expensive, hard to find Japanese CDs. And I often, a lot of people won't do this. I'll spend $25 on an album or a CD that I haven't heard. Right. I mean, most people were like, I'm not spending $25 unless I've Googled it 50 times.
Right.
So I ordered those two CDs from Japan, put them on. And within days I was like, oh my God, this is like Nick Drake. I can't get enough.
Yeah.
And then over the next couple of years, I discovered that there was this unreleased third album that some guy was sort of selling CDRs of on the internet. So I bought one. And one day I just had this epiphany, like, and not like the CDR guy was by any means getting rich. It's not really a money thing, but I just thought, well, you know, it seems like the family should be getting some money. And it seems like this should come out for real. It was that good. And so this was the tail end of the phone book.
Sure.
You know, some of your readers probably don't even know what a phone book is.
Right, right,
yeah. I'm joking here. But anyway, I found, I don't know how I did it. I Googled and Googled and phone booked, and I found her nephew. and called him up, and he was eager to, you know, kind of make a deal. Like, yeah, you're right, and that led to some more research, and somebody figured out that there were master tapes and actually multi-track tapes to this album. Then we got the bright idea to have Jim O'Rourke remix it, and by remix, I don't mean make it sound contemporary, but it just needed a final mix.
Right, you know? Right.
And so that became the third album, Dreams Come True. From there, it led to me helping be part of the, there's like a BBC live album that we put together, and so on and so forth. So I really became over time an advocate for her estate, which is a couple of nieces and the nephew who unfortunately has since passed. And so one of my things that I did for the movie was really be kind of like another historical thing is when Jimmy Carter brought Anwar Sadat and Menachem Begin to Camp David.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Because the thing about filmmakers that I found, many of them, the ego is like the size of Texas, right? They think that they're curing cancer.
Hans, I feel like they almost, it has to work that way to some degree, right?
Yeah,
like
you need the chutzpah, right?
Yeah.
So the filmmakers, and I definitely saw their side. I'm not throwing them under the bus here, but you know, they really
felt like,
you know, we're the greatest guys on earth and we're doing the world a big favor. And they are, and they were, because they weren't wealthy guys.
Right.
And the estate felt like, you know, it's time for someone to finally pay us what this stuff is worth, you know? So I was really sort of the middleman on that. And then also, you know, her first two albums, of course, are owned by, you know, Elektra Asylum, which is a major corporation. And, you know, they didn't think that the Judy Sill stuff is worth the same as their Led Zeppelin. But nevertheless, you know, that had to be stroked and, you know, and so I really became a little bit of, and I often do this with reissues, I'm really a psychologist.
Putting your music up online is not always the easiest thing in the world to figure out, but DistroKid makes music distribution fun and easy with unlimited uploads, and as an artist, you keep 100% of your royalties and earnings. A million plus artists rely on DistroKid to get their music into Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram, all the major streaming services. You can use it to edit your lyrics and your song credits. So important in the internet age to let people know the kind of people you're collaborating with. And DistroKid makes that easy. You can also see all your stats from the streamers and, of course, add a credit card to purchase album extras. The DistroKid app is available now on iOS and Android. Go to the app or Play Store to download it. Especially when you're talking about an artist who didn't receive their due in their day, right? I mean, Judy, of course, passed away, wasn't around to advocate for herself. But nonetheless, I'm sure her family rightly had a sense of this stuff is gold. It's beyond good. It should have been massive, and it should have been. Watching the movie, I found myself, learning a lot about who I think Judy might have been. You know, obviously she wasn't a untroubled person. She had her own demons and was struggling and dealing with all of that. But regardless, the songs are just so incredible and so top level. And I think about how in some ways she really is like the synthesis between, you know, church music, sacred choral music, and, you know, and sort of like Brian Wilson said that Pet Sounds was supposed to be like a teenage symphony to God, you know?
Right.
In some ways, I feel like Judy's on that same, she's in that same zone where there's a sacred dimension to what she's doing. You know, but then when you learn, she came from beyond rough and tumble background.
I think the last time we really spoke was about a year or maybe a year and a half ago, where I was cruising down Ventura Boulevard and you were probably in Arizona. And we were discussing this topic about Judy's sort of spiritual quest through music. And we folded in Van Morrison.
Right.
And some others. And Judy Sill's best friend was a guy named Tommy Peltier, who I've become good friends with, who appears in the film. And he's had his own music and things. I put out some of his music. But, you know, some other writer approached me trying to nail down Judy's, you know, was she a Protestant or was she a paganist or was she, you know, and he had a great pun. He said it was Judaism.
Yeah, that's funny. That's incredible. and very, I mean, she does have her own, like her completely her own thing where there's an element of mystic Christianity, but then there's also little dashes of theosophy. And it seemed like a lot of folks, she was interested in UFOs in a sort of spiritual. I think it's on the BBC thing where she apparently hated performing live, but her stage banter is like ace level. It's very good, very funny, very entertaining on its own. But she makes some reference to enchanted sky machines, you know, UFOs or things like that. But
Right. You know, I mean, Van Morrison is a combination of mysticism, Christianity, sort of New Age stuff, Eastern Zen,
throw a dash of Scientology in there maybe at one point or another.
Theology. Yeah. I mean, you know, and that's what makes these artists interesting to me. You know, the ones you can't fully pin down.
Yeah. There's a heretical, I mean, it, on one hand, it's like, like you said about Van, he is all of those things. And then he'll make a statement like, one of my favorites, which I included in the Pitchfork review for Three Chords and the Truth, was he says something like, I wouldn't touch religion with a 10-foot pole or whatever, you know? And it's like, so much of his music has been explicitly driven by his religious convictions or explorations. So I kind of like, that's what I like about art versus dogma, right? Is that in art, you can just make it up. You can just, heresy doesn't exist in art. You know, that's what's great about
it. Yeah, well said. I mean, you know, look how many times Bob Dylan has disagreed with himself.
Of course. I mean, but how we all do that, right? That is the trick is recognizing that you don't agree even with you, you know? That's what makes us human.
One of my favorite Pete Townsend songs, actually recorded by The Who, is called How Can You Say You Know Me When I Don't Even Know Myself?
Yeah, wow. That sounds, I need to check that one out.
That's like a Who's Next era B-side. So go diving on that one. It's good.
Yeah, any excuse to go diving into the Pete Townsend back catalog, I am fully on board.
And another guy obsessed at various times with spirituality, the whole Maribaba.
Oh, Easter
thing. So anyway, we could laundry list these guys all day. Richard Thompson, of course, and others, you know.
Who I was so blown away, you know, when I got to read his book, which was really good, Bee's Swing, I think is what it's called. Very, very well written, very engaging. And then, you know, he came on the podcast and I was already, we're going to dig in. I'm going to get him to really open up about his Sufism, his belief, his mystic, you know, Islam. And he was just kind of like, you know, I felt mystically inclined at times or whatever. That was like, sometimes when you talk about it, you deflate it, you ruin it. You don't manage to get to it. It's not something you talk about always. Maybe sometimes it's more something you feel. And I feel like that comes through in Judy's work. But dreams come true. I mean, that's such a remarkable collection. And I know it wasn't streaming for a while, but now it seems like it is, which is really good. So I think people can get access to it.
I'll have to check that out.
is it not supposed to be?
I don't think it's supposed to be. Do me a favor. If you can look at the stream and see who it claims is, if there's any sort of copyright owner, let me know.
Yeah.
It theoretically was supposed to be taken down. Basically, without getting into a whole big music business thing, I helped the family get the rights back.
Yeah.
And I'll be thankfully reissuing it myself sometime in the next 12 months.
That's great. And you know, so when you started hearing rumors about those recordings, did you know the whole backstory regarding Michael Nesmith and Emmett Rhodes, these like other figures who are deeply mythic in their own right, you know?
I didn't. And you know, here's what's really funny is Emmett Rhodes, who of course is no longer with us, has had no memory of recording that album or meeting her.
Huh.
Right. I mean, he literally was like, who's that? Right.
Fascinating.
Yeah, that was fascinating. And then I think with Nesmith, again, now deceased, I think it was just a matter of using his studio, but I don't think that he intersected with her either, unless I'm misunderstanding, you know.
Sure, sure.
But nevertheless, there is a Nesmith-Emmett Rhodes connection, was more practical and pragmatic. In other words, we need a studio, we need an engineer, and this is who it is. And, you know, it's funny, guys who've lived a full life don't remember everything. For example, there's a famous engineer, I think he might still be alive, I think his name is Roy Haley, who's best known to Simon and Garfunkel fans for doing like the incredible sounds of like this Bridge Over Troubled Water album. Now, he also did a Light in the Attic thing that I didn't have a big part, but I partially helped see it through, was the infamous Miles Davis, Betty Davis album.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, which is kind of a weird album anyways. So he engineered that. He didn't remember anything. Like, you'd think, okay, dude, you're in there with Miles Davis, who's larger than life. You're in there with Betty Davis.
Somehow right? Larger than life, even than Miles, in a weird way. Yeah.
I know what you mean. And he didn't remember anything. Huh. But you know, I think for certain people, you know, like, you know, and this is definitely the Wrecking Crew for sure. But, you know, when you're doing a lot of work,
right,
and then years go by, it's not all going to be, you know, I mean, I even find sometimes someone will go, you reissued the blah, blah, blah. Right. I'm like, wait, tell me what that is again.
Right.
I have to think about it. Like, if you go to my Discogs page, I think there's something like 500 or 600 reissues by this point.
I did. And I was blown away. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't remember them all, you know,
yeah.
or if you remind me, I might, but you know, it's just, and so when you look at, you know, bigger names who've done a lot of work, especially in a studio, it's all in a day's work, some of it. You know?
Sure, sure.
Just is, you know.
Well, speaking of studio work, as I mentioned, there is a new Mushroom album on the way. One of my favorite titles of the young year so far, Messages from the Spliff Bunker. Is that, did I get that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, okay, here's the backstory on that. Mushroom generally doesn't rehearse in the sense that we're all sort of improvisational. When we make an album, it's a lot like a live gig, except there's no people there, right? Some of the other members of Mushroom who've kind of put together various splinter groups off of Mushroom have owned or rented a rehearsal studio in Oakland for the last 20 years. And so they would often get together without me or in smaller groups and record their own albums, whatever. And so about a year and a half ago or so, I happened to start dropping by there a lot. And the next thing I know, I'm behind a drum set and it's Mushroom. And one of the guys started recording it on a laptop with a bunch of microphones. So almost everyone in Mushroom except me are massive weed heads.
Sure.
Right? Like they love their weed. Now, normally at a gig, I'm not really part of it. They probably get high before the gig and they get high after the gig. And while I'm propping up a bar stool or talking to a friend, they're out and back getting high. So I don't really think about it. I'm not really part of it. While making this album, every 20 minutes, was a weed break.
Right.
Right. And so I was sort of irritated, like, I don't really want to smell this, even though we're outside. I find this to be a waste of time. Whatever. Okay. So this folds into the Clash. And you might say, what the hell does the Clash have to do with mushroom? Not much, except I was reading an article about the making of Sandinista, where, you know, they did, you know, a triple album set, and they're in New York City in a recording studio. And I guess Joe Strummer had a huge cardboard box, probably like a refrigerator box or something. And in the middle of a session, he'd go in there to get high, and that was called the spliff bunker. Right?
Yeah.
And so as I'm reading that, I was flashing back to the mushroom experience, and I needed an album title. And so I came up with Messages from the Spliff Bunker.
I love it. I love it. And I think that this is obviously music that is well suited to herbal intoxicants.
Oh, yeah. No,
if you're down.
It sounds like we're high.
Yeah.
It makes you feel high, and it's great music to get high too. So I don't want to, like, you know, I know I'm coming off here like I'm Mr. Anti-Weed. I certainly have inhaled a few times, but I'm just not like chronically like, oh my God, if I don't have a joint in the next 20 minutes, I'm going to have a nervous breakdown.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's a great listen too. I mean, it's wild. It's like nuts. There's always like so much energy going on. Is this a two drummer configuration?
Actually three, for Christ's sake.
Wow.
It's two
okay.
sets and a percussionist.
Right.
And we've mixed it super stereo. So I'm in the middle because I'm sort of like, you know, the Buddy Rich, Ginger Baker band leader.
Yeah.
Einstein, who's actually one of the owners of Amoeba Records, he's making his debut with Mushroom. So he's on one side with another drum set. He also did all the crazy psychedelic artwork inside and out.
Yeah, cool.
Our mutual buddy Daryl Norson helped put it into place.
The man. Daryl's as good as it gets.
Yeah, and then longtime mushroom percussionist David Brandt is playing all kinds of cool, weird stuff, and he's mixed on the other side. So it's quite amazing stereo spread. You know, it's almost a 5.1 mix without actually being 5.1, you know.
That's really cool. That's really cool. And I know that, so you sort of reactivated your label, Heyday, for this release, right? Heyday Again is a company, record company sequel is how it's put in the notes, which cracked me up.
Yeah, so real short, in the late 80s, I started a label called Heyday, and it was all sort of me putting out a lot of my favorite bands, or favorite artists from bands that broken up. The Rain Parade had broken up, and mm-hmm. so I signed Stephen Roback. Green on Red had broken up. I signed Chris Kakavas and Jack Watterson. 28th Day had broken up. I signed Barbara Manning.
Yeah.
And so that label was called Heyday. And without getting to a big, long thing, I eventually left that label, and it sort of petered out and whatever. And so I kind of felt like I wanted to not start like, you know, Heyday was a very active label. Right? I'm looking for bands. I'm trying to break bands. I wanted to just have like an outlet for me and my friends and my pet projects. And so I dug up the old Heyday logo and had Daryl just copy it exactly, but change it from Heyday Records to Heyday Again.
Yeah.
And obviously I signed myself, Mushroom, Allen Ginsberg album.
Right.
Is on there. It looks like the Judy Sill album will be on there. So, you know, I'm in no way like going, you know, please send me your demo tape, you know, kind of thing. But it's really just a little boutique thing of mine. So yes, Heyday Again, the sequel.
All right, I'm gonna cross off my list of things to do. Don't send Pat demo tape.
I will say this though, actually, and all kidding aside, if friends are looking for an outlet where they don't want to self-release.
Sure, sure.
Dig you got it. My number.
Dig it. Yeah. Dig it.
Yeah. There's I'm doing some of that. Yeah.
There was something I really liked, which was that you referred to the vinyl edition as the ultimate retro band gets more authentic. And this is what I really liked, right? Because there's a...
Yeah. I know where you're going.
You and I have, I think all this time on social media, always gone back and forth.
We've butted heads on some of this stuff.
Goofed around, had fun. I will say, though, nothing cracked me up more than you saying, essentially, for this release, no color vinyl, just regular black wax, no tip on jacket, double vinyl, $22. To me, all I was thinking was, this is so great, and I love that Pat's money is where his mouth is, because you are somebody who, obviously, you've been putting out records and been involved in the record industry for a long time, and you've no doubt seen this sort of rise of the vinyl record as a sort of boutique fetish object, which is good and bad as far as I'm concerned. It is both, of course, like everything else is to some degree. But I take it that maybe you're a little burned out by the general the specialness of everything coming out these days.
Here's the thing, you know, when I got into the reissue business like 20 years ago, once in a while you'd have a cool color variant, right?
Sure.
Or once in a while you'd say, gee, I'm going to spend the big money and have, you know, George Clooney remaster this one, right? or gee, this is such a cool thing, you know, let's do that stout and tip-on jacket, right? But what's happened is many of the labels that we know and love, this is happening on every release, which means it's no longer special. And then the marketing is just this, right? Mm-hmm. When I started the reissue business, it was more like a super obscure 1973 album produced by, you know, Robert Fripp of King Crimson featuring, you know, Mike Nesmith on pedal steel. 15 songs that will remind you of Nick Drake on crack.
Okay, right.
That was the marketing angle. Now, there's nothing about the friggin' music. It's super double, triple thick, quadruple thick, multicolored, swirled, orgasmic vinyl mastered by the legendary blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Quadruply, you know, like, let's get back to the friggin' music, folks.
Yeah.
Because here's the deal. If this is a friggin' great record, let's buy it because it's a friggin' great record.
Yeah.
Not because, like, you know, it's a Robert Rauschenberg art piece that is going to be hanging at the Met in 5 years.
No, yeah. I absolutely know what you mean. It's funny to think of it in sort of like, you know, Marshall McLuhan style, the medium is the message. In this case, the format of the object is sort of the main thing that people throw out there. And I, as much as I like, I love records, but I also like CDs, and I also like tapes, and I also like digital-only releases. Whatever it's got to be to make sense and to work, that's all that matters, right, is the music. Yeah. And I think we have lost a little sight of that.
But I swear to God, go into a record store and look at the stickers that are on the front of albums by all the key reissue labels and tell me if there's more than a sentence on the actual music. And then count how many sentences are on mastering over the vinyl.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's like, let's get back to the music, gentlemen. You know,
I will say, and this is something that I think it's not a reissue per se. It's not a reissue at all. But last year, a great guitarist, Hayden Pettigo. I don't know if you know him.
I helped Hayden early in his career too, a little bit. I know Hayden. He's a character. Yeah.
He's a great character, and I think it's like, we were talking and he had his label Mexican Summer. They put the best guitar album of the last 100 years on the marketing sticker. And of course, when we were talking, he was like, I mean, what a ridiculous thing to say, right? He knows full well that that's a funny joke, but it also, I thought was, I was so into it. It was so funny to me. And I would like to see weirder, more wild pressed stickers. Let's get these hype stickers really imaginative again. Like you said, you know, I want to bring back Nick Drake on crack type hype stickers.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And those are the kinds of stickers. I don't get asked to write stickers too much anymore, but if you go back and you look at some of the Lightning Attic releases and some of the other labels I've been associated with, if you see a sticker that's a little wacky from some of those labels, there's a good chance
you were involved. Yeah.
Yeah. That I helped write it because, you know, that's, you know, like, let's just put a little pizzazz into this, guys. You know, this is supposedly rock and roll.
Yeah.
Not, not classical music, you know, not that I'm dishing on that, but in other words, you know, it feels right now that it's all in a suit and a tie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like let's let it rip.
Yeah. You know? I'm now wondering, I'm trying to scan the memory banks and try to remember there was a Bill Fay, Time of the Last Persecution reissue that said something like Ray Davies meets, and I can't remember what it was, but it's what you're talking about. It was the thing that made me go, I have to listen to this right now, you know?
Yeah. And one of the things I've started doing since I've become a semi well-known author, I'm obviously not a household name by any means. I love writing back cover blurbs for other people's books.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I've done quite a few of them because they usually have that kind of vibe, you know, imagine Norman Mailer running into, you know, blah, blah, blah in a dark alley and coming up with a novel or something, you know?
Yeah. I love it. Now,
yeah. I mean, that's sort of like, you know, old Warner Brothers, Warner Reprise marketing was like that. Or even it's a little bit of a tribute to National Lampoon. If you don't resubscribe to our magazine, we'll shoot this dog.
Right.
You know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. No, the golden age of ad copy. Yeah. I love where you're coming from there. Well, yeah. I know we've touched on a bunch of stuff. We've touched on the Judy movie. We've touched on Ginsberg. We've touched on Mushroom. Do you have, are you in book mode for the new year or?
You know, believe it or not, there's another book coming right on top of the Ginsberg book. This is due out in March. This is called Grievous Angels, Trout Mass, and American Beauties.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
1970s rock and roll. Does this look familiar?
It does. Is this also coming out from Fantagraphics?
This is also on Fantagraphics. And basically, I'll just kind of quickly read the back cover blur, but
sure.
In the early 70s, Ginny Nguyen became the first in-house staff photographer and the first woman photographer to work for Warner Reprise when their roster was John Cale, Grateful Dead, Van Morrison, Jimmy Webb, Kate and Anna McGarrigle, Emmylou Harris, Grant Parsons, Captain Beefheart, Alice Cooper, Frank Zappa, Bonnie Raitt, Tim Buckley, blah, blah, blah. And so this is a book of those photos. And then in the mid-70s, she left Warner Reprise and went to work for Norman Seeff, who was a well-known sort of celebrity photographer. And she's doing Carly Simon, James Taylor, Joni Mitchell, Jodie Foster, Gloria Swanson. She even did Alice Coltrane. And so this is a woman that no one's ever heard of, really. And I just, me and Jessica Hunley, you might know Jessica Hunley,
mm-hmm.
you know, we just went through and
selected some of your favorites.
Yeah. And the other cool thing, unlike most of my books that weigh a ton and cost a lot of money, this is only $20 soft cover, price to move. You know, again, I'm trying to kind of get into this marketing of like, let's bring it back to like, you know, look, you see this for $19.99, it's a very good chance you're going to buy it.
That's right. That's right.
A hardcover book that costs $70, you go, I'm not sure I need that, you know?
I mean, if you're like me and you're looking for any excuse not to pick up a book because you have bought way too many books, yeah, right. A $70 price tag will usually, at least partially,
I mean, I also,
dissuade me.
You know, I'm the manager now of a band some of your people would know called the Dream Syndicate.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And so we're putting out a double vinyl set that includes a DVD of a movie, and the whole thing is a $29.99 retail.
Beautiful.
You know, again, very similar to the Mushroom. You know, it costs a few dollars more than Mushroom because the DVD is in there, but it's the same thing. Like, let's just get back to, I mean, there was a time when Warner Brothers used to do these promotional albums that were $2.
Right.
And it had like a Joni Mitchell track, a Neil Young track, a Van Morrison track, a Zappa track, right? You know, I want to get back a little bit more into that.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. And I'll tell you, the Dream Syndicate are one of those groups where the more recent records have just been so good and so exciting that you get the sense that they're like deeper and headier than they ever even were. And that's wild and great.
Yeah, you know, I was such a fan that when they decided to get back together, I was certainly excited. And obviously the live shows were as great as ever. When they decided they'd actually go into a studio, I was a little bit nervous, right? Like, is this going to take the legacy of this incredible band and bring it down. And
sure.
And I think they've not only maintained the legacy, but with some of the weirder records, like the last two, they've maybe even elevated the legacy a tad, which is pretty hard to do, you know, when you're 40 years out. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. But a really inspirational situation. And, you know, Pat, it's been such a great hang talking with you and chatting. Thank you for taking the time, and thank you for doing the work that you have done and continue to do. It's a real, for those of us who like the idea of contributing and helping to, you know, sort of get the word out about things that we really care about. I think you're a big inspiration on that front for me personally. So it's always a good hang, no matter if we're recording or not, as you've alluded.
Well, the only thing I'll say, and I look, I know I'm a big complainer, but I also do a lot of hard work. And so my advice to other people is complain less, work more.
Oh, well, you know what, man, your complaints, and the first, they're always so fun to me. I enjoy like a little grousing, and I think that a little grousing is good for all of us. And,
Sure.
And like I said, you know, you being able to prick a little hole in the sort of vinyl fetish zone is really fun to me, and I love all of that. And so I'm a big, I remain a big fan of what you're up to. So Pat, thank you so much.
All right. Take care.
Take it easy. Be well.
Bye-bye. Cheers.
Bye. Thanks for tuning in to Aquarium Drunkard Transmissions. I'm Jason P. Woodbury. I write, host, and produce the show. Transmissions is edited by Andrew Horton, and our music comes from Frank Mastin. Art for this episode was created by Ian Everett, and our show's executive producer is Justin Gage, Aquarium Drunkard's founder. Don't miss his radio program, The Aquarium Drunkard Show, on Wednesday nights, 7 p.m. Pacific Time on Sirius XMU, Channel 35. If you are looking for a way to boost this show, consider sending this episode to a friend or leaving a rating and review wherever you listen to podcasts. Of course, I care a lot more if you could just nudge a friend who you think might actually enjoy this conversation. Peer-to-peer, passing along, that's what we're doing here. My buddy Chris Schlarb recently referred to it as a back-to-the-land movement for online living. And on that note, I'm going to encourage you to head over to Aquarium Drunkard, where you can check out nearly two decades of music journalism, interviews, great stuff in the archives to listen to, playlists, mixtapes, Lanyap sessions, the Aquarium Drunkard picture show, podcasts, interviews, it's all there. So head over and check out Aquarium Drunkard, where you can subscribe to support independent music journalism in 2024. Transmissions is part of the Talkhouse Podcast Network. Visit the Talkhouse for more interviews, fascinating reads, and podcasts. Next week on Transmissions, I am joined by the brilliant Moore Mother. I hope you will join us. Until then, be well. This transmission is concluded.